today on Against the Grain, a sort of farewell in the form of a retrospective and a sharing of thoughts, professional and personal, on my last day as a regular host of this program. I'm CS, excerpts from cherished interviews and perhaps too much of me holding forth, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. I didn't want to make a big deal of my decision to sort of retire, but some people told me I should, so here we are. At the end of this month, I'll be stepping down from my position as regular co-host and co-producer of Against the Grain. But I don't plan to step away completely from this program, this project that Sasha, Lily, and I created more than two decades ago. You still might hear my voice now and then, because I currently plan to occasionally sit in for Sasha, who I'm delighted to say will be taking over as this program's sole host and producer. More capable hands, I cannot imagine. And you know, some people say things like that to be polite or gracious. I'm saying that because I believe it, and I know it. Today I'm serving up a combo platter of thoughts and reflections and excerpts from some of my favorite interviews. In a sense, this farewell undertaking began yesterday when I presented an interview I decided I couldn't just present portions of today. If you didn't tune in yesterday to my 2016 interview with the late, great Saba Mahmoud, talking about secularism and religion, you can find the audio on againstthegrain.org. I've done a ton of listening over the last few weeks, going through Against the Grain audio archives and focusing especially on interviews from the show's early years. I was reminded that this program took on the name Against the Grain in 2004, exactly 1 year after Sasha and I began co-producing a show then called Living Room on March 3rd, 2003. So Against the Grain is technically 21 years and 8 months, and if you want to get really specific, 22 days old. Fundamentally for me, because I don't want to put words in Sasha's mouth, this program has been an intellectual adventure. I like ideas. I like theory. I like philosophy. I like history. And many moons ago, I thought, and in this case, I know Sasha did as well, that a kind of anti-intellectualism pervaded the media, including, very much including, left media. What to do about that? How to combat it? Which brings me to the first interview excerpt I'll present, from a 2004 interview with Liza Featherstone and Christian Parenti about an article they co-wrote with Doug Henwood titled "Action Will Be Taken," that's in quotes, "Left Anti-Intellectualism and Its Discontents." Liza Featherstone is a journalist, essayist, and critic who currently teaches at Columbia and NYU. Christian Parenti is a writer and now professor of economics at John Jay College, City University of New York. One thing they take aim at in their article is activistism. I asked Liza Featherstone what that term meant.
That was kind of a funny word we made up. And what we're trying to convey with that is that there actually is no real ideology behind contemporary activism except the belief in itself, the belief in taking action and in activism. So our term activistism was meant to sort of paradically call attention to that problem.
The point of this whole article was not that there should be less activism, but that there should be an acknowledgement that thinking and the work of thinking is important. It's not decadent, and it's not a waste of time. And that even though it might not have immediate impacts, it has very important impacts. And part of what goes along with this is a whole reframing of the kind of time frame of the work we're involved in as leftists, that there is a real emergency on every front on this planet. You know, the war, the environmental crisis, the declining standard of living of people, all of these are serious emergencies. And so the motif of action often becomes one of emergency. No time to think, no time to waste on the frivolities of a book. We have to take action now, which is true. We have to take action now. But the fact of the matter is, these problems are not going to go away anytime soon. They are massive problems. And the left is not on the verge of taking power and making these problems go away. So really what we're engaged in is actually a quite long-term struggle. And one of the key terrains in that struggle is the sort of a set of assumptions that people operate with. And in writing this article, we were really sort of, you know, responding to the right and how they have, for 30 years or more, waged a very assiduous campaign to control not just information, but people's assumptions, the very framework with which they will receive any new information. And we just feel that the left has not, in recent years, taken very seriously that battle for ideas, that battle for assumptions, the terrain that frames any new information that one will receive. And as part of that, that in a lot of movements, people who come in as activists are not, as it were, given an education by the institutions that they relate to. And a central question should be, are they going to be, in a way, converted to a profound, you know, left understanding of the world and have the tools for the rest of their life to make sense of the stories and lies that will be thrown at them? And will they know how to take the right positions and move forward in new contexts?
Christian, you just mentioned this question of time, that there's so much emergency stuff going on that many people might argue there's no time for in-depth structural analysis. You know, we have campaigns to win, atrocities to prevent. Liza Featherstone, in thinking about and writing this article, was there some other argument made by, say, activists that you heard or that you recorded in your piece that reflects a hostility to intellectualism based on something other than, you know, we just don't have time?
It is deeper than that, although that's the "we don't have time" is a perennial objection. I think it has to do with the context of anti-intellectualism in American culture. And when people are organizing protest movements, they often are tapping into a kind of populist tradition that confuses anti-intellectualism with anti-elitism. So that's certainly one problem. And I would also say that it also has a lot to do with the Puritanism on the American left, which is shared in the larger American culture but often expresses itself in very particular ways on the left, that there's an attitude that, you know, we don't want to be too indulgent, you know, with all the terrible things, you know, going on in the world. You know, how can you, you know, spend time reading Adorno? That, you know, thinking is seen, as Kristen said earlier, as decadent. And, you know, there's a real hostility to anything that is seen as indulgent or decadent.
What about this question of elitism, Christian? You have spent a lot of time doing graduate work. I think you have a PhD. And theory often isn't easy. It often tends to be the domain of academics in this country. Could an emphasis on analysis and theory in some sense privilege or exalt or elevate the academically inclined in a way that doesn't benefit the left as a whole?
It could, and to the extent that it circulates these days, that's often the way it does. It becomes a specialty for academics who very often are people who aren't interested in communicating with a larger audience, and I think there's a whole, you know, kind of a duplication of the Catholic Church's use of Latin among the priesthood. You know, there's the liturgy is in Latin, and the Word of God, et cetera, et cetera. You know, wasn't until much later translated into the vernacular. Academia suffers from that same kind of split, speaking a secret language and a celebration of obscurantism and all that. But that's not the fault of big ideas. That's the fault of the academy, and the left and the right in the academy do that. And what we're arguing is we're not arguing that everybody should be a theorist, and we're not arguing that we're not even arguing that there needs to be new theory invented. What we're arguing is that there needs to be work done around the role of ideas. And we've, again, repeating myself here, we're very much influenced by how the right did this. And the right did this starting with, in many ways, with von Hayek. He noticed that the left in the 1930s had just sort of swept the terrain of assumptions, and that the mainstream notion of things was increasingly that the market was bad, that it led to inequality, that it led to crisis, that capitalism was an unfair system that needed regulation through a democratically controlled state. And for von Hayek, right-wing Austrian economist, this was an absolute disaster. And he convened a group of intellectuals called the Montperlin Society and said to them, you know, look, we've lost the immediate battles here. The other side has the high ground. But what we can do is we can wage a generation-long struggle to change the assumptions so that people will see the market as the only path to freedom and see private property as totally legitimate, et cetera, et cetera. And then did that through a series of institutions, namely think tanks, and getting people at those think tanks to use the press. So now that project wasn't about inventing new ideas. It was just about promulgating a set of assumptions and always pushing in any specific struggle or any specific sub-argument, always pushing a set of assumptions. And I think the left needs to think about, well, what are the kinds of assumptions that are part of our analysis of what justice is and what's wrong with this society, and how do we advance them constantly? Any opportunity we have, how can we work on this terrain of building a set of progressive assumptions so that these problems that arise again and again in politics are confronted by people who have a set of real core assumptions about, you know, among other things, we would argue capitalism and what its real nature is. And I think a lot of people don't really want to discuss capitalism explicitly because they feel that if you do that, the only option is that if you have a theory of capitalism that fundamentally problematizes it, then all you're doing is arguing for revolution. And if revolution isn't on the agenda, then that's irrelevant. And we would argue that, no, even when revolution isn't on the agenda, understanding the real nature of this system is very important for waging better, more effective reformist struggles, which is a lot of what, if not most of what, the American left is actually doing.
Liza, what happens to people who are discouraged or who aren't for some reason pushed to consider ideas, let's say after they finish a campaign on a single issue in a certain place?
Not thinking about the bigger picture or the bigger analysis really encourages single-issue politics. So, you know, after you win this campaign that you're working on, say a living wage campaign, you know, or you don't win it, you just move on and do something else and drop out of activism altogether, because, you know, no one has really encouraged you to make the connections between living wages and global warming, you know, and the war in Iraq. I mean, that because when the big ideas aren't discussed, people really don't make the connections between issues, and there's no real incentive or motivation to stay in the movement after winning on a particular issue.
Liza Featherstone and Christian Parenti talking about ideas, theory, systemic analysis, stuff I've tried to focus on over the years with my guests. You heard Christian talk about assumptions, prevailing assumptions that, you know, have become a sort of common sense, carefully considering and pushing back against harmful and sometimes pernicious assumptions, social, political, economic, environmental, has been a passion of mine since I can't remember. Of course, not every program we present goes deeply into ideas and assumptions and structural analysis, but I think the emphasis we've placed on such things makes this program unique, makes Against the Grain sound different, because it is. And just to say that this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, I'm C.S. Song, and you're listening to a sort of farewell show. I'm stepping down as regular co-host of this program, although I do plan to sit in for Sasha now and then. My biggest thrill has never been to get on lefty superstars, you know, the left luminaries a lot of programmers chase after. I've always gotten more of a thrill out of finding the thinker or scholar activist who's laboring in obscurity until I invite them on to talk about something they've written for a scholarly journal. Yes, I read such things. Or in a book not written for general audiences. That's exciting for me. First time public intellectuals, giving people who aren't contacted, let alone noticed by the media, mainstream or otherwise, giving them a forum. I like to go to academic conferences. I've been to many of them, and it's great to hear often a young scholar giving a fascinating lecture and getting them on the program to talk about their work, something they've investigated in depth. But, you know, there are exceptions to that. One was when I got to talk with Slavoj Žižek, regarded as a sort of academic rock star by many people on the left. The philosopher and cultural critic joined me in studio in August or September 2008 to talk about his book, Violence. Here's the inimitable Mr. Žižek commenting suddenly in mid-interview on our program's name.
It did strike me now how glad I am to be here, because the name of this radio station where we are making the interviews against the grain or the program, yes. And I think this is the difficulty of the left today. The old traditional Marxist left could still, how should I put it, rely on what in my Lacanian jargon I would have called big other, on some kind of historical necessity, you know, like history is on our side. Today, I don't think so. I think that if anything, the objective historical tendencies point towards catastrophe, ecological catastrophe, some kind of new authoritarian society. If we act, if we will succeed to act, we will have to act against the grain, precisely, with no guarantee, you know, this Stalinist self-satisfactory guarantee, oh, we are just instruments of some higher historical necessity or whatever.
Later in the interview, I asked Slavoj about what he thought of the discourse of tolerance, of how we are told to be tolerant of people different than ourselves.
Tolerance is crucial, and I'm opposed to it. Why? For a very simple, not because I'm for intolerance, but, you know, it's an ideological notion. In what sense? Ideology is for me not simply dealing with pseudo-problems. It means something very precise. You have a real problem. I'm the last guy to deny that racist intolerance, sexist intolerance, and so on are not real problems. But the catch is that the very way we perceive a problem is part of the problem. The very way we perceive the problem mystifies the problem. Tolerance is like that. Why? Let me take racist intolerance and let me make a simple experiment. Look at Martin Luther King. If there is a figure of anti-racist struggle, it's him. Go on the internet, download his speeches and put search and look for the word tolerance. You will almost not find it. For him, racism was not a problem of tolerance or intolerance. It would have been for him even, and he was right, of course, humiliating to claim we blacks want more tolerance from the whites. It's in the same way as for a woman who is fighting for feminism, it would have been ridiculously humiliating to say we want to be more tolerated by men. It's ridiculous. You change it into soap opera, no? Mm-hmm. For Martin Luther King, racism was a problem of economic exploitation, laws, legal regulations, and so on. Something totally different. So the question is, why do we today automatically perceive or translate racism into a problem of tolerance? That's ideology. At this level, I think we have to fight today. You know, Freud put at the beginning of his Traumdeutung, Interpretation of Dreams, a line of Virgil, where he says, if you cannot move the earth, things on the surface of the world, try to move the underground. Maybe this is the best slogan for the left today. We cannot make now a revolution move things on the surface of the earth. Let's move the underground. Let's engage in how people are talking, how they see the problems. The worst position is cynicism here. It's to say, oh, it doesn't matter how we talk, what matters is how we act. No, The way we act always depends on how we talk.
And I think Slavoj would add to how we talk, how we, as he said earlier, how we see things, how we perceive things. You heard him refer to moving the underground, which this program is in large part about. You know, what's the underground? What's the ideological basis for decisions that are made and attitudes held by so many people? And how can we move that underground? How can we expose and undermine and refute harmful notions, harmful ideological notions? This kind of work is serious business. Was any part of this job fun? Certainly. One fun thing was to sense a guest realizing at some point during an interview, usually early on, that I had done my homework, that I had engaged with their writings. It was fun to notice them relaxing into our interaction, shedding anxiety about whether they'd be asked substantive questions, whether they'd be able to unfold or unfurl their arguments. And then there were times when I'd have a laugh with my guest, or even, on rare occasions, make them laugh. The scholar activist Bettina Aptaker joined me in studio in August 2007 to talk about her memoir, Intimate Politics, How I Grew Up Red, Fought for Free Speech, and Became a Feminist Rebel. Bettina at the time was a professor of feminist studies at UC Santa Cruz. She is now Distinguished Professor Emerita. I asked Bettina about her father, Herbert Aptaker's claim to radical political fame.
Of course, the 1950s was the height of the McCarthy period, and my father was called upon to testify both before the Senator McCarthy's committee, which he was forced to do by subpoena, and also he testified voluntarily as an expert witness on Marxism and communism at a lot of the trials of people who were accused under the Smith Act, beginning in the early 50s. The Smith Act was conspiring to advocate the overthrow of the government by force and violence.
Got it.
So it was a sort of conspiring and advocacy, very murky land. And so I think it was from that sort of testimony that he became known in the New York Times, would refer to him. It was sort of like they'd say his name, comma, the Communist Party's leading theoretician or something like that. And then in the later 50s, I think around, maybe 56, he became editor of Political Affairs, which was a theoretical organ of the Communist Party. It wasn't called that because of the legalities, so it was called a Marxist journal or something, but everybody knew that it was the journal of the Communist Party. That was one side of his life. And the other side of his life at the same time was he was a historian, of course, of African-American people. And his most well-known work is probably the documentary History of the Negro People in the United States, which is 7 volumes.
And then Bettina talked about her radicalization, about what she learned that inclined her toward Marxism and the Communist Party. But we skip ahead to her participation in the free speech movement. She told me about helping to launch the W.E.B. Du Bois Club, which she described as a socialist youth organization, while attending UC Berkeley. I asked Bettina what decision was made in the fall of 1964 about the status of the strip of sidewalk at the southern entrance to the Cal campus.
Basically, the regents of the University of California had a long-standing policy that did not allow freedom of speech on the campus. If you brought a speaker to the campus, it had to go through a faculty and administrative committee. If the speaker was deemed to be controversial, you had to have a debate format, or the speaker could be prevented from coming altogether. Students could not distribute leaflets, they could not set up tables, they could not solicit funds, they could not hold rallies, and so on and so forth. So all of those free speech activities were conducted, as you point out, at the southern entrance to the campus at Bancroft and Telegraph, and we used to get permits from the city of Berkeley. and they regulated just time, place, and manner. So, you know, you wouldn't have four rallies going on at the same time. That was all. And the tables had permits from the city of Berkeley to set up, and they were set up in front of the kiosks as you enter the campus so as not to impede the flow of pedestrian traffic. 64, as you said, September, the regents announced that that strip of sidewalk did not belong to the city of Berkeley, but belonged to them, that it was part of the property of the University of California, and they extended the ban on political activity all the way to the curb.
And how did the students react? And what kind of role did you play in the protests? I'm especially interested in dates like October 1 and 2, 1964, when, as many people know, thousands of students surrounded the police car that brought police in to, I guess, arrest a graduate student named Jack Weinberg.
I was in charge of setting up the table for the Du Bois Club. When the ban was announced by the regents and was enforced by the local administration, all of us were affected. It didn't matter what your political views were. There were young Republicans that were out there trying to campaign for Goldwater or Scranton. Well, it was Goldwater by then. And people campaigning for Johnson and the Democratic Party and all the civil rights organizations. And everybody was equally affected. This ended up, therefore, in what we called the United Front. And we had representatives from all of these different organizations coming to have a discussion about what to do. And I was immersed in this by accident because I happened to be the person in charge of our table. So we defied the ban on political activity by setting up our tables. The administration came out, a cabal of deans came out and started taking everybody's name. And as soon as they took somebody's name at a table, that person got up and another person sat down. After one day and one hour, they had over 800 names, because that's how many people were sitting down at all of these tables. And it was astonishing. The United Front met, and I remember Mario very clearly. Mario Savio at this meeting, and he pointed out, he said, look, if the object is freedom of speech on the campus, why should we limit ourselves to this strip of land on Bancroft? Why don't we move our tables to the center of Sproul Hall Plaza? It seemed very reasonable to us, and that's what we did. And as you said, Jack Weinberg was arrested. They brought a police car to the very center of campus at 12 noon. I mean, it wasn't the brightest thing to do. And thousands of people surrounded the car, sat down around it. Jack was in there for, I think, 32 hours. Mm. They amassed more than 950 law enforcement to attack us, which would have been on October 2nd, which I believe was a Friday. And it was at 7 p.m. that we were supposed to disperse, or they would disperse us. And Mario and a group of other people, I believe Jackie Goldberg was one of them, were involved in negotiations with the administration. Clark Kerr was involved by then, no longer the local administration. It involved the governor, who was Pat Brown, and Clark Kerr, who was then the president of the university. They negotiated an agreement which allowed us to disperse and that Jack would not be prosecuted and so on. There was a series of agreements. My first public speech was from the top of that police car. It was an amazing experience. I remember Art Goldberg and Mario helping me up the police car and then helping me down from the police car. And we all took our shoes off so we wouldn't damage the car, which, of course, we crushed the roof, but it was not intentional, just from our weight standing
exactly.
on top of
the police car. Exactly. You didn't scratch it. You crushed it.
Right. You asked me about my involvement, and I was just in the free speech movement. I was just going to say that Clark Kerr was alleged to have made a statement quoted in the Hearst Press that 49% of the demonstrators that had surrounded the police car were communists or communist sympathizers, which is ridiculous. And we had a meeting and we're trying to figure out what to do about the communist baiting. And Mario said, I have the solution. Let's have the one real communist actually speak at the next rally. And that was the start. I spoke at every rally after that. And Mario and I and Jack and Mike Rossman and so forth were the closest of colleagues as we worked on the steering committee together. Suzanne Goldberg also, there were a whole bunch of us, there were 11 of us, to marshal this movement.
A bit later in the interview, Bettina Aptaker shared more details about the Free Speech Movement's steering committee.
It was myself and Suzanne Goldberg and Mona Hutchins, and I believe we were the three women on the steering committee. it was a 11-person committee, so we were definitely a minority. And I might add that we were also a virtually totally white movement, which seems astonishing now in retrospect, but at the time on the Berkeley campus was totally white. In that year, 1964, I've been told on good authority that there were a total of 100 black students on the entire campus of 27,500. So you get some sense of the segregation that actually existed at this time before affirmative action and so on. And there were virtually no black faculty. And I don't have any memory of faculty of color at all. I don't have any memory of Chicano or Native American or Asian American faculty. Anyway, that's just a sidebar, but that should be noted. My experience in terms of the free speech movement was that women were part of the movement, an integral part of the movement, but we weren't listened to, like in the meetings and so forth. My role was totally derived from my prominence in relationship to my father, although I am certain that I was loved and appreciated by my male colleagues on the steering committee. I'm certain of that. Joe Freeman and Jackie Goldberg were also very active on the executive committee, not on the steering committee, very prominent. In any event, we were part of this together, and here were these very articulate, very intelligent women and very limited access to being able to articulate their views in meetings. A lot of times the dynamic was they would say something, then the men would continue talking as though the women hadn't spoken at all. And then one of the men would say something that a woman had said 15 minutes earlier, and everybody said, oh, that's a great idea.
You spoke out. You outed yourself as a Red to the public, to the U.S. public. You became quite famous. And then the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia.
Yes.
In August 1968, it extinguished the Prague Spring that so many people found as a real source of hope for progressive politics. What position did you take, and how did the U.S. Communist Party respond?
Let me just say that I had had a nervous breakdown in March of 1968, and there was the invasion. And part of how I was coming out of the crisis was I was reading Marxism myself and reading people like Dubček, who was a key figure in the Prague Spring, for myself. So I was breaking out of the orthodoxy at the same time that this was happening. So I had independent knowledge of the ideas. There was a French communist named Roger Garraudy, who was also very important to me as I was reading, as part of the French uprising, the student uprising, which is almost at the same time. So I was very, very distressed by the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Soviet Union. And I was a member of the Communist Party's executive committee. It was it was called the National Committee of the Communist Party. And I went back to that meeting in September of 1968. So it was just after the invasion. And that was what was on the agenda. And so it was my first public outing after this breakdown that I'd had. And I opposed the invasion. And I spoke at the meeting to oppose it. And then there was a vote. And of 120 members of the National Committee, there were only three of us that opposed the invasion. It was myself and Al Richmond, who was then editor of The People's World, and Dorothy Healy, who was the chairperson of the Communist Party in Southern California. And that was a real crisis for me. It was the first time I really opposed my father, and we really argued, we really fought about the issue because he supported the invasion. It was a very important moment for me personally. And I remember Gus Hall, who was chairman of the Communist Party at that time, in a very condescending way saying to me, you should always do what your pop says.
Really?
Yeah, as part of trying to cajole, so-called cajole me. And I wasn't moved by that. On the contrary, I was quite angered by that. I thought it was very condescending. So that's part of the beginning of my breaking away from the sort of orthodoxy in which I had been raised.
Bettina Apteker went on to articulate her goal of, and this is in her memoir, Intimate Politics, her goal of transforming the orthodox Marxism and Leninism of the 19th and early 20th centuries into a vibrant force for a democratic and humane socialism. I'm C.S., And I want to remind listeners that this is a special sort of farewell program. I'm taking leave of my post as regular co-host of Against the Grain, but I do plan to sit in for Sasha now and then. Now, Bettina is clearly a reader of books. What she reads, what she has read, has informed how she has approached issues and what choices she's made and actions she's taken. I myself love reading, and I want to urge you, if you don't read much, to read more. Consuming media is great, but there's no replacement for really getting into a good book. That includes fiction, by the way. Fiction keeps me sane. I also encourage people to ask more questions, including in everyday conversation. So many people I interact with socially don't ask questions. They don't evince any curiosity. Are they not inquisitive? Are they shy or bashful about asking questions? I find I learn a lot more when I ask stuff than when I talk about myself. Asking questions also flatters the person you're talking with, and you get to learn about who they are and what they think. Humans are fascinating creatures. Between patterns and trends on the one hand, and the day's breaking news on the other, I'm almost always drawn to the former. What is the context for some new development? How did things get to be the way they are? What forces are at play? Which notions hold sway? What sorts of ideas are being ignored or suppressed, and why? Slow, gradual, incremental tendencies and processes tend to be overlooked, but they can explain so much. Of course, I've also been drawn to certain historical events, especially ones involving momentous ruptures or transformations. The Haitian Revolution, the Paris Commune, the Russian Revolution, the Spanish Revolution, 1968, just to name a few. One earth-shaking development was actually a series of events collectively referred to as decolonization, when, over several decades beginning in the 1940s, one country after another broke free from colonial rule. The historian and journalist Vijay Prashad joined me in studio in, I think, May 2007 to talk about his book, The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. At the time, Vijay taught international studies at Trinity College in Connecticut. He currently directs Tricontinental, Institute for Social Research. Vijay talked about the demands made by countries of the so-called Third World, demands he abbreviated as peace, bread, that is, economic reorientation, and justice. You'll hear Vijay mention Bandung, by which he means the 1955 conference in Bandung, Indonesia, where delegates from 29 Asian and African countries gathered to denounce colonialism and chart a path forward. I asked Vijay whether he thought of the Third World as a place.
The Third World was not really a place. The concept Third World comes in the 1950s, and it refers to this massive upsurge in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, this upsurge of people demanding a different kind of world, both for themselves, for their countries, but also for the planet. And the demand that they made wasn't an unspecific demand. It was specific. There were some actual things that they wanted to see changed. The combination of all those things that they wanted changed was the project called the Third World.
Give us a thumbnail sampling of the nations that broke free from their colonizers in the period of the 1940s through 1970s, just so people have an idea of what we're talking about.
Oh, it's a mass of countries. The early countries that had influence in the Third World Project was, of course, India in 1947 and Pakistan in 47, Indonesia in 1948. In 1952, the Egyptians had a revolution led by some very dynamic military officers, among whom was the most charismatic Gamal Abdel Nasser. Then in 1957, Ghana, led by the movement under the leadership of Kwame Nkrumah, breaks free from British colonialism. And in 59, you have, of course, this extraordinary event take place in Cuba, when from the hills of Cuba into the city of Havana come Fidel Castro and his platoons. So in the span from 1947 to 1959, there's a seismic shift in the world of Asia, Africa, and Latin America as these countries break free from colonial dominion and hope to create a new kind of world for themselves. You know, and again, it's not just a world for Cuba, India, Egypt, Ghana, but a new kind of world for everybody, including the Europeans.
In talking about third world nationalism, Vijay, you write two things. You write about the extent to which anti-colonial nationalism, third world nationalism, relied on or rejected defining the nation in cultural or racial or religious terms. And on the other hand, you refer to third world nationalism as internationalist nationalism. And I think these two things are related. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. You know, it's fascinating when you think of Indonesia and India as just two examples. Both Indonesia and India share the same cultural motto. And the motto is not out of many one, you know, which is the motto of the United States, but unity in diversity. Where, look, the point is, you know, there are 500 communities inside this state formation. The furthest thing for us to do is to try to homogenize them culturally. I mean, in India, there are 27 recognized languages. There may be over 300 distinct languages spoken in the Indian Republic today. So to say, look, you know, we're going to everybody has to speak one language is counterproductive. You're going to actually go against the sense of people's cultural dignity. So what united people during the colonial period, what united them was not so much that they had a culture in common. You know, if you go back to the 19th century, to France, to other places, you'll see that the uniting myth of Mazzini in Italy, of the French state in the 19th century, was that they were French people, they were Italian people, and they needed to be reunited. I mean, that was the term used in Italy. The reuniting of unification of Italy was a reunification of Italy under Victor Emmanuel. Or in Germany, you know, when the different small baronies were brought together, it was understood as the bringing together of the German people. They were already German. They now needed to come into a common national, platform. Hitler's Anschluss was to unite, the Anschluss, to unite the German people. In the colonies, this was an absurd idea, because there was just so much diversity of population, of cultural, habits, etc. So what united people in their struggle against colonialism was the struggle against colonialism. I mean, from the mid-19th century right out to the 1940s, this is a very long culture-making process. And the culture was a culture of anti-colonialism. You know, in India, for instance, it was wearing a certain dress, a certain homespun cotton cloth to say we don't buy foreign cloth, certain kinds of caps, certain, you know, gestures, certain way of walking. New cultures of defiance were produced. In Algeria, you get the same thing. You get unities produced in that moment. So their nationalism was a nationalism which was simultaneously secular in that it wasn't marked by religion, it wasn't marked by one kind of language or some kind of cultural overlay, and it was to some extent socialist. In other words, the new nation that was born had to deliver to its population. It was not enough to say, look, pals, you know, we're all French now, so let's learn French and let's bond together. The thing was, we have taken power because we can deliver goods that we told you the colony can't. In India, for instance, one of the uniting features of the anti-colonial movement was that the British Raj was draining the Indian economy. That was the phrase they used. It's a drain. So if the Brits were draining the Indian economy, the new Indian government could not continue to drain. It was a socialistic piece was there inside the nationalism. The piece of the anti-colonial nationalism was somewhat secular. It was somewhat socialist. And, you know, when I use these words, I use them in the broadest possible way. Because many of them were anti-communist. Many of these people also had some kind of cultural visions of their own. But broadly, it was ecumenical. It was open to all kinds of features. They were multinational nations. Now, at the same time, you get this at Bandung very strongly. At the same time, they understood that, you know, it's one thing to be a new nation. It's another to be chauvinistic. I mean, they recognized a couple of things. One is that from the 20s onwards, there was talk of the renaissance of continents. There was talk of, in 1937, the Nigerian author writes about African Renaissance, the name of his book. Nehru gives speeches in the 20s onwards saying this is a renaissance in Asia. You hear the same things from the right and the left in Japan, saying this is a renaissance in Japan, in Asia. Mao also talks about Asia rising. So there was one understanding of a continental solidarity. There's this new anti-colonial nation, and then there's continental solidarity. And then beyond that, why was the Bandung Conference the conference of Afro-Asia? It was beyond just Asia. It was people who have come out of colonialism have something to share with each other. They could trade together. They have cultural matters they need to fight against chauvinism. That was the principle of internationalist nationalism.
We skip ahead to Vijay talking about two problems faced by countries engaged in anti-colonial struggle. Some of his remarks relate to the Algerian struggle. The FLN is the National Liberation Front in Algeria, and Ahmed Ben Bella was a leader in the Algerian War of Liberation and the first president of independent Algeria.
There are two different problems that occur. One is objective and one is subjective. The objective problem is faced by almost all anti-colonial struggles. What happens is, while they were battling the colonial enemy, it was necessary for all parties to unite in what they call the mass party. It was very necessary. You couldn't have six different parties because they were, in the case of Algeria, fighting a military struggle. So all the more reason for political and military unity.
These are like different social classes, people of different incomes and wealth and religion.
And different political views. Liberals, Marxists, Trotskyites, nationalists, Islamists, everybody came under the FLN. You know, and in some ways they were also forced under the FLN when the FLN became popular. In India, for instance, it was the Indian National Congress. I mean, this phenomena of the mass party in Ghana, the Gold Coast Convention Party, all people come into it. It becomes the mass front against colonialism. So that form of the mass party is adequate in the fight against the colonial enemy. The day you take power, you see, the mass party, heavily organized, seizes control of the state and now says, we're in charge. But the problem is, when you're governing, you don't want one party. You want to have the different class interests freed so there can be some rattling around so that you can actually politically deal with the different classes. What happened was they tried to administer a political problem. You know, they took power of all features of society and gradually tried to strengthen the hand of the president. And when there were any class tensions, they tried to deal with it administratively. They jailed people, or they, you know, expel them from their jobs, etc. They didn't deal with it politically. They didn't go to the people and say, look, here is what we believe. Here is the way to go. In fact, they demobilized the population. And this is the subjective element. The objective element, look, this is a problem they all faced. The mass party comes to power, it becomes a one-party state. Many African countries, in fact, institutionalized the one-party state into the constitution. But at any rate, the subjective part is that once you've come into power, even if you're a mass party, like, for instance, in Cuba, where all parties went behind the Castro regime, in Cuba, they didn't demobilize the population. In fact, they continued to mobilize them. Platoons were created anew, named after heroes of the revolution, to basically do the military work, you know, after the Bay of Pigs. That was a real, reminder to the Castro leadership that you need to allow people to be ready, armed and ready to defend the revolution. In Algeria, they demobilized the population. Now, what that did was, it isolated Ben Bella, and it strengthened the old social classes, the old elites, who made an alliance with the military. They come out and knock off the president, and there's military rule. I mean, the reason there's military rule in so many of the countries that follow the Third World Project has nothing to do principally with these countries being prone to military or authoritarianism. It's precisely because there was a subjective mishandling of an objective problem, the problem of the mass party when it takes power.
Vijay Prashad talking with me about his book, The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I have a bit more to present, but I want to take a moment to ask you a favor. I want you to support Sasha Lilly, the very smart, talented, hardworking person who will take over as the sole host and producer of Against the Grain. Socially aware and very sophisticated in her political thinking, Sasha deserves your support. And I invite you to respond to today's program, to something you heard, maybe you have a memory or impression you'd like to share with me. I can be reached at againstthegrain@kpfa.org. You can reach me there even after December 1st. I want to bring in Vijay Prashad one more time, very briefly. Here he talks about intellectual work in relation both to the Third World Project and political projects more generally.
So we need to bring people to a common project of the caliber of the Third World Project. And, you know, one of the reasons I wrote this book was to show that, look, we used to have a project. We don't have a project now. Let's put our intellectual energies into thinking about a project, because that's intellectual work. You know, the struggles happen, and the role of intellectuals is to understand and study struggles and to systematize them. And then to go to the people and say, what do you think about this? And the people will say, I agree with 50%, I reject 50%. And then you go back, think some more, and come back. We should be doing that. We need to work towards creating a project. We don't need to just show the people's grief to themselves. Intellectual work is not a mirror of grief to humanity, writing about suffering. We need to take from people's suffering, produce political projects, and then go and find the legs for those projects for the future.
I think Vijay's message about joining intellectual work with projects for social transformation, or about doing intellectual work in service of social transformation, is critically important, theory and practice, not just reporting suffering, thinking back, and also thinking forward to new vistas and possibilities. This is what I've tried to do with hundreds of guests over the years. Hopefully some of what they've said has benefited you, informed you, inspired you. And I do want to thank our listeners. They, you, are ultimately what drive this program. It's been an amazing, exhilarating experience to serve you, to offer you what I found and discovered. I'm grateful, I have been so grateful, for your presence and support.